The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. First, we have a story on the unique properties of spider silk.
Right, Sarah, this story is all about what makes spider webs so flexible and yet so strong.
So it's more than just the composition of the silk. It's also the arrangement of the fibers?
It is. What researchers already knew is they knew that spider silk is very unusual. If you can imagine a spider dangling from a single thread from the ceiling, and I'm sure a lot of us have seen that, if you actually pulled on the thread, it would be elastic for a little while, but if you kept on pulling, it would actually stiffen up again, which is really unusual. And researchers knew that during the elastic stage, there's proteins in the spider silk that are scrunched into these intricately folded structures, and pulling on the silk actually disentangles these structures. And when there's no more knots to untie, the proteins reconfigure into tough structures called beta sheet nanocrystals. And that's what makes the silk get stiff again when you continue to pull it. So they already knew that, but they did know was how this worked on a web-wide level. You know, webs are much more than just hanging pieces of silk. They're very intricate designs. There's a lot of spokes and a lot of other stuff going on the web. And so the researchers wanted to figure out what's happening sort of on the web-wide level that's allowing these webs to be so flexible and so strong.
And they did this in a pretty neat way.
Yeah, they did, Sarah. Basically, what they did was they actually went out into the wild and they found some spider webs and they hung these tiny weights from them to approximate a fly getting stuck in the web. And they wanted to see what happened when individual spokes in the web stretched so much that they snapped. And what they found is when this happened, other threads wouldn't break with them. So it was just the individual spokes that snapped. And they found that even when 10% of the spokes snapped, the web still retained its original strength. But they weren't satisfied just with going out into the wild. They actually wanted to run some computer simulations as well. And they fed a bunch of web designs and different elasticities into a computer. And they found that what it really is that makes spider webs so amazing is that they can be stretchy or stiff at different times. And that produces threads that flex and then snap in just the right way to avoid wrecking enough spokes that would really damage the integrity of the web as a whole.
So spiders can preserve their web through some insect-based damage. What about an application for this more generally?
Well, right. Well, one of the reasons researchers are so interested in spider webs is because they are such unusually strong, flexible materials. And scientists are always interested in taking nature and making cool applications from it. And so one of the researchers actually wants to genetically engineer spiders so they can spin threads with properties not even seen in nature that are even more amazing than what we see currently. And one could only guess at what kind of applications that could have. So stay tuned for genetically engineered spiders.
I will. So the next story is more about how plants have been engineering the planet. They might have triggered an ice age.
That's true. This next story is all about an unusual relationship between plants and global climate. Now, what the history is here is about 460 million years ago, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was very high. It was about 14 to 22 times higher than it is today. And this created a world that was about 5 degrees on average warmer than it is today. So there's a very hot place to be. And then something unusual happened. About 455 million years ago, Earth experienced 2 major glaciations. A lot of the land on the planet was actually covered in ice. And the only way this could have happened is if there was a dramatic reduction in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, so it traps a lot of heat. The less carbon dioxide you have in the atmosphere, the colder the planet is going to be. But researchers haven't been able to figure out what caused such a dramatic drop in carbon dioxide.
So was it actually plants taking that up out of the air, or is there more to the story?
There's actually more to the story. That's what I would have suspected as well. But it turns out that this actually has a lot to do with the weathering of rocks. The weathering actually allows them to pull carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And this forms minerals that actually trap the carbon, keeping it out of the air, and the Earth gets cooler. But the problem is that this weathering doesn't happen fast enough to have accounted for this dramatic drop in temperature that happened 455 million years ago. So something else may have been playing a role, and that's where plants come in. And what scientists have shown in the lab is that some of the earliest land plants actually weathered a lot of these rocks very quickly and allowed the rocks to take up a lot of carbon. And they show this by actually putting a bunch of rocks in sealed beakers inside the laboratory. And they added some moss, specifically a modern-day species of moss that's believed to be very similar to some of the first land plants. And what they found was that the presence of the moss significantly increased the weathering of the rocks. And what they did next was they actually fed all this data into a climate model, and they found that if these land plants covered about 15% of Earth's surface, which is what scientists have assumed, they would have weathered enough rocks to have resulted in a drastic decrease in carbon dioxide, enough of a decrease to have resulted in the major cold snap that was seen 455 million years ago.
So this wasn't the only time this has happened, right?
Right. In fact, there was another major glaciation about 10 million years after this first glaciation. And the scientists say that what it may have been responsible for that was actually not the mosses, but another group of plants known as vascular plants. And today's vascular plants are plants like ferns and flowering plants, which similarly may have weathered rocks and caused another dramatic drop in carbon dioxide levels.
Okay. Last we have a mechanism for massage and why it makes us feel better.
Right. Well, we all know, any of us that have had massage, that massage feels good. Actually, turns out it seems to do good as well. Studies have shown that it actually does relieve pain and it seems to relieve inflammation. But scientists don't know how, or at least they didn't know how until this new study came around. There was some speculation that maybe massage squeezes lactic acid, which is this byproduct of exertion that can cause sore muscles. It literally squeezes it out of the muscles, or maybe it somehow filters other waste products out of the muscles, and that helps us heal faster and makes us feel better. But nobody was really sure what was going on until this new study came along.
And so they found some people who are willing to exercise for science?
Right. 11 young men, they put them on these grueling upright bicycles and made them basically work out until they were completely exhausted and completely sore. And then they had a massage therapist come in and only massage one of their legs. So I'm sure the other leg didn't feel so good. And before, during, and after the experiments, they actually took tissue samples from the legs of all the volunteers, and they compared the legs that got massaged to the legs that didn't get massaged. So the first thing they saw, which wasn't terribly surprising, was they saw a lot more inflammation in the post-workout samples and the pre-workout samples. And when we exercise a lot and we damage our muscles, which happens during exercise, obviously you're going to get a lot more inflammation. They also saw a lot more signs of cell repair going on. So that wasn't surprising. But when they compared the two legs of each guy to each other, what they found was they found these big differences in a couple of genes. One is called PGC1-alpha, which is a gene that helps muscle cells build mitochondria, which are the engines that turn the cell's food into energy. Massage legs also had three times less NF-kappa-B, which turns on genes that is associated with inflammation. So there was these big molecular differences going on between the legs that got massaged and the legs that didn't.
So they saw more healing, less inflammation after the massage?
Exactly. And what they didn't see, which was also kind of surprising, they didn't see any evidence that massage removed lactic acid or any other waste products. So it doesn't seem like the traditional view of why massage works actually holds up. But there's actually a much more interesting thing going on.
Myth busted.
Right.
Well, David, what else do we have on the site this week?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about how giant storms can churn the water, even in the very deep sea. Another story about why dinosaurs got so big. For Science Insider, we've got a story about why thousands of scientists are boycotting a major academic publisher. Also a story about the current crop of Republican presidential candidates in the United States and what their stances are on science. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat is about peak oil. Is the world's oil supply running dry? And next week's chat is about the science of love, time just a few days before Valentine's Day. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
I will. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.